Our goal tonight is to learn a little bit about dealing with difficult times, with challenges, from a perspective of emuna, of connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And we're going to use the Holocaust as a context to do this. And so when I was discussing with Emma what we thought you guys might want to do and what want to learn, is that we thought about breaking this into two different segments. This being more of an introduction and an overview to the time period and personalities. And then if there's interest, to do a follow-up specifically related to the Pesach experience, because there are amazing stories and resources that we could share with you that specifically hone in on the experience of Pesach as it relates to the Holocaust, and could be potentially, for those who are interested in this kind of thing, potentially could be very inspiring. So tonight we're going to start with an overview, and you have in front of you, I'll actually do the screen share so you could see it along with me. We're going to think about and explore together an overview of the Holocaust. And we're going to do this by looking at three figures from three different periods related to the Holocaust from three different countries. So you're going to get a very wide lens here of examples of spiritual resistance in a difficult time. And we can draw upon that for our own challenge. Obviously, on one level, we can never even imagine the level of intensity and persecution and suffering that they had, not even an ounce. But it's something that we can tap into. So if you're following on the screen or on your own screen, on your Prezi, we're going to stop for our first country before the war in Germany. And you see on the map here, right near Würzburg, which is not too far from Nuremberg, is a small city, a town called Kitzingen. You guys see it? So in Kitzingen, there was a Jewish community. This is a picture of the main hotel in Kitzingen. This is a picture of the beautiful shul that was constructed in the 19th century. And in Kitzingen, in 1900, 1910, 1920, the Rav of the shul, the Rav of the community, was a man by the name of Rabbi Joseph Wolgemuth. Rabbi Wolgemuth was the spiritual leader of the congregation in Kitzingen. And in the early 1930s, he passed away as a very young man. And he was succeeded by his son. There's actually a Holocaust survivor today who lives in Indiana. When I told this story to someone at the museum, at the Holocaust Museum, they said that they connected with this Holocaust survivor in Indiana who remembers the levaya, the funeral of Rabbi Joseph Wolgemuth. Could you imagine? This man remembers that levaya. It was 1935, I believe. So Rabbi Wolgemuth passes away in 1935, and he's succeeded by his son, Rabbi Isaiah Wolgemuth. You'll see right here. Rabbi Wolgemuth was a young musmach of the most prominent yeshiva in Germany at that time. It was known as the Beis Medrash L'Rabbonim, the Beis Medrash L'Rabbonim al Shem Rav Azriel Hildesheimer, known as the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary. So in Berlin, there was a major yeshiva with some very prominent rabbeim, Rosh Yeshiva, leading the yeshiva, let's say the author of the Malamed Lahoel, the Gaon Rav David Zvi Hoffman, and later, when it was closed, it was the Sri Yesh, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, one of the greatest Gaonim of Europe of before the war, and they were leading the yeshiva, and this young rabbi, Rabbi Isaiah Wolgemuth, who had just turned 20 years old, became the Rav in place of his father in Kitzingen, Germany. So he is now taking over the community, but what's happening in Germany since 1933? What's been going on there?
Pogroms.
Well, I would say anti-Jewish laws, right? The Nuremberg laws, other anti-Jewish persecution, right? And yet, I'm going to put it on the screen now. You can read along with me. You can see. This is what Rabbi Wolgamuth writes about that time. Because after he was taken away during Kristallnacht in November of 1938, Rabbi Wolgamuth was then taken. He was taken to Kristallnacht. He was released and he ran away. He emigrated to America. He moved to Boston, where he joined the faculty of the Maimonides School, teaching together with Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. And one of the main things that he taught, and there are people in the community now who remember this, he taught Be'er Tefillah. So he wrote a Sefer on Tefillah called Guide to Jewish Prayer, which is what you're looking at in front of you. And you see it on the screen. You see it there? Can you see it on the share screen? Tell me now, can you see it on the shared screen? If you go back to the...
No, I just see the president.
Let me see if I can do that. Hold on. Now do you see... Oh, no. It says my... Okay. Oh, I see what's happening. You can't see this. Only I can see this. I don't know why, but that's the way it is. So I'm going to read it for you. I can email it to you later. You ready? You're going to trust what I'm reading? I'm going to read it mila by mila. Here we go. Says Rabbi Wolgamuth, I have classified the years from 1933 to 1939 as another golden age in Jewish history. Does that make sense to you guys?
Not really.
He says, you might think it's strange to refer to those years as a golden age. Are they not the beginning of the Hitler period, years of tragedy, the years that immediately preceded the Holocaust? They were the years in which the Jewish people were deprived of all basic rights and classified as second-class citizens. I lived through these years and I think of them very often. Hitler came to power and we knew there was no future for the Jewish people in Germany. We knew that the history of 1,000 years in Europe had come to an end. Always hopeful, we believed we might escape, etc. Can you believe this? He says, the challenges of those years might have frustrated most people in the world, but it did not frustrate the Jews in Germany, who in spite of all the obstacles, difficulties, and hardships, dedicated all their free time to learn Torah in the widest sense of the word. I personally studied in those years at the great Telz Yeshiva and the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. My father Zatzal passed away in 1935 and the community invited me to become the successor. I was of the opinion that I had years of spiritual work ahead of me. In those years, the Nazi dictatorship did not interfere with Jewish studies as long as we did not interfere with the Nazi plans for the future. This is what he writes. Suddenly, everyone in my congregation wanted to learn Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaal Peh. They wanted to attend classes in the many fields of Jewish scholarship. I was busy. I'm skipping a little bit. I was busy every hour of the day. And what happened in my congregation happened all over Germany. The most assimilated Jews wanted to increase their knowledge of the Jewish studies. Amazing. And he says that this was true among the Orthodox rabbis. He names the monks, Wolgamuths, Cohns, Breuers, Bieberfelds, Karlbachs, and others. He says they taught Gemara almost all day and all night, but it wasn't just Gemara. It was other topics too. The highlight of the week in every community was, guess what? The rabbi's drasha. He said, today, not so much, but in those days, nobody wanted to miss one word of the drasha, both in the Orthodox community and the liberal congregations. He says, some of the sermons I delivered in those days are still fresh in my mind. So what's the first response? Remember, at this point, Eastern European Jews are fine. The problem is, in Germany, they were suffering persecution. And yet, what happens? What do people do? How do they respond to the crisis?
It sounds like they all came together to learn Torah and to dedicate themselves more in their Avodas Hashem.
So, and even if they didn't understand the word Avodas Hashem, they found ways to connect more to Yiddishkeit, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to themselves, to their inner Jewish soul, even just to the Hebrew language, to learning Hebrew, to something meaningful. Amazing. That's example number one. That before the war, when things were difficult, he mentions even the names of some of these rabbis, Rabbi Prince and Rabbi Nussbaum. He said they were naive. They didn't even think that what they were doing was dangerous. They had so much love for learning. The rabbis and other teachers, they were so committed, and the people were so interested. He writes that on Shabbos he overheard people discussing the depression they suffered because of the uncertainty of the future. What does Rabbi Wolgamuth say? This inspired me to deliver sermons that were geared to restoring their courage, self-confidence, and hope for the future. And then he goes on to quote the drasha in Parshas Vayetze. So we're living at a time where people are depressed and uncertain. So what do we need to do? We need to come together to re-engage our learning, our identity, our confidence, our courage, and our hope. That's number one. Questions, comments, or observations on Rabbi Wolgamuth?
It seems a little disconcerting. I'm just having trouble with that. Then they had all this uncertainty and they responded and emunah. But then the worst possible happened. So it just seems like, I don't know, a little bit scary on our end. We don't get to see, if we're in that same boat. It's very scary for me to wrap my head around that they responded the same way that we're trying to respond.
So, because ultimately the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world, and our circumstance obviously is very different than theirs, but it wasn't so much about he's not saying that this is how we staved off the future decree, or this is how we were spared from the worst calamity in Jewish history. He's not saying that. What he's saying was, this is how Jewish people responded to a crisis. Not that that is a way to save themselves. Now, it's true. In hindsight, I think he probably would have said, everybody should have, crawled on their hands and knees and gotten out of Germany. Okay, had they known, hindsight's 20/20. They thought they would wait it out, like in many Jewish communities, even throughout the war, down the line. It's a longer discussion. It's an ongoing debate. But what he's saying is, irrespective of what happens in the future, that only the Ribbono Shel Olam can take care of. We can't predict the future, but what we can do is deal with the here and now. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Right?
So just saying that, this is how, his point is that this is how Jews respond to tragedy or uncertainty.
Here. Yeah. He's writing this Sefer 60 years later. And he's saying what sticks out in his mind is not the subsequent destruction. What sticks out in his mind is how people dealt with this uncertainty and this depression and this anxiety and this persecution. It's dafka by the resolve of commitment to learning and to sharpening and strengthening our identity. Fascinating, right? You'd never guess that in a million years. Right? Okay, any other questions, comments, or observations on Rabbi Wolgamuth?
I just had a historical question.
Sure.
What year did Hitler rise to power?
1933.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other questions before we leave Rabbi Wolgamuth and we go during the war? Good. Okay. So let's move on. And if you're following in the slides, we're going to move during the war from Germany to Poland. You see the man in front of you? You recognize him? If you recognize him, let's see a hand. One hand. Okay. It's very important to meet this man. His name is Rav Klonimus Kalman Shapira, Hashem Yikom Damo Zechus Yagon Aleinu. He's known as the Piasetzner Rebbe. Piasetzner was born in 1888 into a Hasidic family. His father died when he was very young. He was raised by his mother. He married as a teenager, and his father-in-law was Rav Moshe Hapstein, who was the descendant of the Koznetzer Magid. His father, Rav Elimelech of Grozitsk, was himself a Hasidic rabbi, and he was an incredibly gifted and brilliant educator, mentor, leader. So Rav Klonimus Kalman has a yeshiva in Piasetzner before the war. He was known for supporting his students, but also Hasidim. He had a tremendous medical knowledge. He was very involved in the field of medicine and pharmacology with people. And the Rebbe finds himself at the outbreak of the war in Warsaw. He's there with his son and some of their family. The war breaks out on September 1st, 1939, right before the Yom Noraim. And then on the second day of Sukkot, well, shortly thereafter, in a bombing of Warsaw, his son is injured. He's taken to the hospital. Shortly thereafter, the Rebbe is visiting his son with several of his family members. The Rebbe leaves the hospital for a brief period. A bomb falls at the hospital, and it kills all the members of his family except for his son. And then his son dies on Sukkot. So at the end of the Sukkot, Yom Tov, by Simchas Torah, the Rebbe is completely alone. He has no children. He has no family. He has no Hasidus. He has nobody. And he decides that he is going to turn his attention to leading, supporting, strengthening, encouraging Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. And he does it with the most incredible and unbelievable Mesiras Nefesh. While he's in the ghetto, he continues that tradition that Rabbi Wolgamuth talked about the Shabbos drushas. Well, the Rebbe continues to give drushas. And he also gives Shabbos sermons in the Warsaw Ghetto. And it's difficult to describe the conditions in the Warsaw Ghetto. There's a very important chronicle. There's a diary. One is by Chaim Kaplan. There's another one, a very important diary by Emanuel Ringelblum called the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, where they describe the conditions that were going on with hundreds of thousands of Jews crammed into a tiny neighborhood with 25 people in an apartment, 5 people to a room, and people, unfortunately, lo aleinu, people dying on the street of hunger, of disease, children. It's heartbreaking. It's difficult to describe. Says the Piasetzner, he says, I'm going to try to be mechazik the people, and I'm going to give Shabbos drushas. And that's what he does. He takes these drushas and he writes them down, and he edits them. At some point, and I don't know exactly how, he came in contact with a man who was another Rav, and also a very important personality in the ghetto. And this man, his name was Rav Shimon Huberband. Hashem Yikom Damo Zechus Yagon Aleinu. Rav Shimon Huberband was a member of Emanuel Ringelblum's Oneg Shabbos archives. You guys know what the Oneg Shabbos was? The Oneg Shabbos was the underground archives of over 20 scholars, researchers, chroniclers who were cataloging and chronicling life under the German rule. And one of these members of this group was a scholar, but he was also a rabbi. He was a published, noted author. His name is Rav Shimon Huberband. So Rav Shimon Huberband was working with Emanuel Ringelblum, and they had documents that they were keeping track of what was going on during the war, and who was responsible for chronicling religious life in the war. It was Rav Shimon Huberband. Rav Shimon Huberband, you can get the copy of this in English. It's called Kiddush Hashem. It was translated, I believe, by Jeffrey Gurak from the Hebrew, from the original Yiddish. You can actually go, just like I did, you can go to Yad Vashem, and I have here a copy. You can get a Xerox copy of the original documents from the Oneg Shabbos archives. Many of them survived, and many of them survived from... Hang on 1 second, I apologize. So Rav Shimon Huber Band is hiding these documents, and you can get a copy of them in Yad Vashem, the Xerox copy. They're buried underground. Most of them survived. Many of them survived. Most of them, more than 60%, I believe, survived. And guess what? At some point in January of 1943, when it became clear to the people in the ghetto that they were going to be liquidated, the Rebbe took the Shabbos drushes that he had given and written down and edited. He put a little note on top of them, and he published them. He put a note on top of them, and he put them in a milk can. And this is, if you look on the page here, if you see, this is the Rebbe's handwriting. This is the letter that he wrote in Yiddish. And he says, please, whoever finds these manuscripts, if there are any rabbis living in Poland, please give them to them and publish them in my name. Otherwise, I have a brother who is known as the Admor HaChalutz. Can you please send them to Israel, to Tel Aviv, to my brother, Rav Yeshaya Shapira? Hashem should have rachmanas on us. He gives these manuscripts, we believe, to Rav Shimon Huber Band. Rav Shimon Huber Band puts them together with the Oneg Shabbos archives, buries them in a milk crate, milk carton, milk can that looks like this. You see that rusty milk carton, metal? That several years after the war is dug up by a Polish factory worker. And he finds in there part of the Rebbe's diary called Savaziras, and another manuscript, and what the Rebbe called Drushos Mishnos Hazam, Shabbos Drushos from the years of wrath. 1943, Erev Pesach, the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising breaks out. The Rebbe survives the liquidation of the ghetto and is sent to something called the Schultz Shoe Factory. From there, he goes to a work camp called Troniki. And then in November, on Dalet of Cheshvan, 1943, the Rebbe is murdered outside of the Troniki labor camp. But the words survive. This is an amazing edition, a two-part edition published by Professor Daniel Reiser. And what you are looking at right now on the screen is the actual handwriting of the Rebbe himself. It's two parts. One part is a facsimile of the actual document, the actual handwritten script that the Rebbe, who knows how he even got paper for this. And you see the Rebbe's edits. If you look closely, you can see how he scrolls and takes things out. You see this? Can you see on the screen now? That is the Rebbe's own handwriting when he went back and edited the manuscripts before he buried them. So I'll share with you one piece. This is from Parshas Chukas, and if we had more time, you know what you can do? You can actually take out a diary of what was going on in the ghetto and pair it together with what's going on. This is Parshas Chukas, Yud Tammuz, July, that means 1941. And the Rebbe is talking about, he's building a drusha. It's the style of drusha that he had similar to before the war. Before the war, he has a collection of drushas that are in this volume that you can get today also. Before the war, this is on the parasha called Derech HaMelech. That's the P.S. Etzner's drushas from before the war. This, the drushas from during the war, his brother published them afterwards called Eish Kodesh. So you can either hear them called Eish Kodesh, but the original, well, he didn't call them Eish Kodesh, he called them drushas Mishnos Hazam. So because this is a distinguished group of women, I will bring to your attention that the Rebbe in this drasha, in talking about the Yeshua, the salvation that we need, he says, we know that bizchus nashim tzidkanios, in the merit of righteous women, the Jewish people were redeemed. Why? Because Jewish women have something called a rechem. Rechem comes from the word rachmonus, chesed and rachamim. Chesed, Rachamim, and Malchus. We have a more of a Kabbalistic idea here. He says, when he's talking here in Parshas Chukas about the death of Miriam, that when we look to create a Yeshua in our world, you know what we need? We need Rachmanus. When we have Rachmanus on each other, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to have Rachmanus on us. And that's why, ultimately, who do we look to for a Yeshua? We look to women. Because women have a rechem, an innate sense of Rachmanus, of compassion. And the Rebbe writes here, to engender Rachmanus on the Jewish people. We have to create and engender within ourselves a feeling of Rachmanus on each other. Not only not just that we have to give to others what we can, to pick up the phone and call our friends, to make sure that they're not alone, that they're not lonely, that they, if they need help with homework, whatever. Not just that. Rak harachmanus ba'atzma, just making sure that we have a feeling of compassion. Shema'orim b'kirbeinu al Yisrael polim b'marom. We cannot become accustomed to suffering. The number of suffering, the incredible amount of suffering of tsar, should not dull. Rather, we should feel our heart melting more and more. We shouldn't feel that, oh, there's so much talk about coronavirus, I can't talk about it anymore, I don't want to hear about it anymore, I want to talk about something else. I can't feel compassion to anybody anymore because it's too much talk. It says, Adaraba, the feeling of Rachmanus that we have amongst ourselves, that we build within ourselves, that is going to be Ma'or Rachmanus from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So what is the Rebbe teaching us? In a time of suffering, we need to look to the women and to a sense of Rachmanus, of Rachamim, to generate Rachmanus. That's our tafkid right now. That's number two. That takes us to the middle of the war. But now let's go to another personality who I really want you to meet. Someone who I never met in my lifetime, but has been so inspirational. You see his picture on your screen? Can you see? Kvod Kedushas Adonenu Moreinu V'Rabbeinu Mikloisenberg, Maran Rabbi Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam. Rabbi Yekusiel Yehuda Halberstam, the Kloisenberger Rebbe.
I think he's from our family.
All right. You got to find out. You got to find out if he's from your family. You got to connect. So I don't have the books here. One of these books is actually at the Holocaust Museum right now, and I can't get it back at the moment. The Kloisenberger, there's an amazing, amazing book about the Kloisenberger. There's several books. He came from Hungary, from Romania, from a major Hasidic dynasty. He had a following, he had a wife, and he had 11 children.
He's from our family.
There you go. He is from your family. That's it. Nice. You're from his family too. You're both together. We're all together. Kol Yisrael, Chaverim. We're all one family. So the Kloisenberger, he had a wife and 11 children. His wife and 11 children were taken to Auschwitz. They were killed. And his 11th child survived most of the war. Just at the end of the war, he passed away. He died. So he ends the war with no one, with nothing. And what does he set out to do in a time of crisis? To rebuild. I'm going to show you now footage. Take a look at this. You see this footage? What does it say? Feldafing, December 17th, 1945. This is actual post-war footage from a DP camp in Germany called Feldafing. Now, if you're looking on the screen, you see there are American servicemen, soldiers with helmets, but you see that man? You recognize that man with the tan pants and the green jacket and the cap? Can you recognize his walk? And why is everyone following him? You see him now, he's walking into the room. And everybody knows this man is very chashuv. And you see the children are making a parade for him. Who do you think it is? It's on your screen right now. Can you recognize that man? Take your American history class hat. You see they're taking pictures of him. Who is that? He has a lot of medals on his chest and he has a lot of demarcations on his shoulders. Who is it? Yes! That's right, Dwight D. Eisenhower. Ike, the Supreme Allied Commander, comes to visit Feldafing, the DP camp. You see him? And he's being followed by thousands of people, throngs and throngs of people. This is going into a hospital. But what's that? This is actual real footage of this DP camp. Shortly after the war, you see people are telling them move away. Eisenhower is inspecting the camp. But you'll see in a minute, as it gets closer to the end of this footage, in about 10 seconds, that he goes into a building. And I want you to tell me what you see is written on the top of this building. It'll be in Hebrew, you'll see in a second. After he leaves this building, right there. What does it say? Base Tefillah. Base Tefillah. Where is Eisenhower going?
A shul.
A shul. Do you know who he's going to meet in that shul? You got it. And do you know what day it is? September 17th, 1945. If you go to heapcal.com and you do date converter and you put in September 17th, 1945, convert date, what day is it?
Can you say the date one more time?
September 17th, 1945. You got it.
Well, lucky guess.
You got it. General Eisenhower visits Feldafing on Yom Kippur. And who does he meet? He meets the Kloisenberger, who's wrapped. Someone gets him a talis, and he starts speaking, and he's crying, and he's speaking in Yiddish, of course. This is described in two books. One is called The Kloisenberger Rebbe, The War Years, and then there's another book by a man who traveled with him named Lieutenant Birnbaum, Meyer Birnbaum, Zichrono Levracha, who went with him. And what did the Rebbe ask for? He needs Tashmi Shekedusha. He needs a lulav and esrog. They need to be able to do mitzvahs. The Rebbe is running around building Yiddishkeit when everything is destroyed. So do you know that Eisenhower arranged that a military plane flew from Italy? Because where are you going to get citrus fruit in Germany? And even before the war in Poland, you couldn't get dal minim in many places. That the American army provided Dalad Minim, Hadassim, Esrogim, Aravas, Lulavim, for Jews? Because when there was a time of crisis, the Rebbe said, we have to build Yiddishkeit. We can't run away. And so it became his life mission to try to help rebuild the lives of these broken Jews. Ultimately, the Kloisenberger settles in New York. After the war, rebuilds his family, his chassidus, and then moves to Israel, where he sets up shop in Netanya, and he builds the Laniato Hospital and many Tzanz Kloisenberg institutions. But the Rebbe taught us that in a time of crisis, instead of going our own ways, we need to find ways to reconnect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and strengthen our Torah and our mitzvahs. We don't have time tonight, but for a future time, the night before, the Rebbe gave an incredible talk after Vidui, after Kol Nidre, after Mairiv, for the members of the broken Jews, the Sheiris HaPleita, the members of the Sheiris HaPleita who came to shul the night before. It's mamash incredible. But to think of these people and the circumstance that they found themselves in, and the ability during a time of crisis, of challenge, to reconnect, to recommit, whether it was through individual Talmud Torah and people finding ways to learn in pre-war Europe, whether it was during the war in Warsaw, and whether it was after the war in Feldafing, people, despite all of these hardships, and we can't really even imagine how, but they did, they found ways to connect to the Ribono Shel Olam, to Yiddishkeit, to Torah learning. And I hope that this gives us a measure of chizuk. What we're suffering through now, lo aleinu, we should never, no one should ever, we can't even imagine. But at least we can take some chizuk in knowing that we hold on to them and we look to them to give us chizuk during this time, to follow their lead in terms of building our own connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu during this difficult time. And hopefully we can use it as an inspiration.